Welcome to this custom deep dive. Imagine you are trying to fix a deeply rigged game of Monopoly, right?
Yen.
But you're halfway through playing it. You can't just flip the board over.
You'd ruin the whole game.
Exactly. You have to like mathematically re-engineer the rules of play while the game is actually still going. And our mission today is to look at how South Africa did exactly that to dismantle historical inequality.
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece of policy.
We are exploring a landmark 2004 document from their Department of Education. It's the proposed amendments to the National Norms and Standards for School Funding.
Which was, just a massive logistical nightmare because, well, the main problem they were facing was that non-personnel funding was unacceptably inequitable across the country.
And by non-personnel funding, we mean.
Right. We are talking about the budget for things like textbooks, desks, electricity, even.
Yeah, the everyday essentials.
Exactly. It was vastly different depending on where you lived. So the fix they came up with was this thing called a resource targeting list. So basically, they grouped every public school into five national quintiles.
But I mean, how do you even categorize a soul's wealth without creating a mountain of red tape?
Well, that is the clever part. You don't actually look at the school itself, you look at the surrounding community.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they use census data, like income, unemployment, education levels in the area to rank poverty. And the poorer the community, the higher the state allocation.
Makes sense.
So for the poorest 20%, which was quintile one, the target allocation back in 2006 was 703 rand per learner.
Okay. And the wealthiest.
The wealthiest, quintile five, was targeted at just 117 rand.
So it functions almost like a progressive tax in reverse, you know? Like a progressive subsidy designed to mathematically level the playing field.
Exactly.
That way, poor parents aren't forced to subsidize basic education out of pocket.
Right. And the reason this matters so much is that it establishes a state adequacy benchmark.
Which was what exactly?
It was set at 527 rand for 2006. That defined the absolute minimum funding required for a baseline quality education. It basically ensures that geography doesn't dictate a child's right to learn.
I am struggling to see how this works safely on the ground, though. I mean, you're taking schools that were historically starved of resources and suddenly wiring them these massive expanded budgets. Doesn't that just invite like total administrative mismanagement?
Oh, it's a huge risk. But that is the exact vulnerability the policy addresses through something called Section 21 status.
Okay.
The government didn't just blindly hand out cash. Schools actually had to prove they had the financial management capacity to handle the funds.
So there was a vetting process.
Yeah. If they could prove it, they got Section 21 status and got direct monetary transfers to buy their own goods.
It is almost like giving a local department a corporate credit card instead of making them file expense reports for every single pencil.
Right.
It really fosters local democratic governance.
That is a great way to put it. And for the schools that lacked that capacity, the non-Section 21 schools, the department just procured goods in bulk on their behalf.
Ah, so they stepped in until the school could get up to speed.
Right, exactly.
But that only really covers the state's side of the ledger, right? Because even with the government buying desks and textbooks, school fees were still creating unjustifiable hardships for poor families.
Yeah, the mandatory fees were crushing people.
Ugh.
So the document introduces no-fee schools to combat that.
Wow.
Basically, schools in the poorest quintiles that hit that adequacy benchmark we talked about, they were strictly prohibited from charging compulsory fees.
Which is a massive policy shift. But what about the schools that did still charge fees?
Well, the state got very granular there. They granted automatic fee exemptions to, orphans, foster children, or learners who were already on state poverty grants.
And they also updated this really intricate exemption formula for families outside those automatic categories. I think this sliding scale is what really stands out in the real-world application.
Oh, definitely.
Because they engineered the formula so that, factoring in multiple children, no parent would ever be legally forced to spend more than 10% of their gross income on school fees.
It is pretty incredible. It shows you how complex formulas can be used to legally mandate empathy and equity within a massive bureaucracy.
It really does. You can see how any modern city could look at these tools to balance their own districts. But there is a fascinating blind spot here, something for you to ponder as we wrap up.
Yeah, the geographic issue.
Right. The whole policy bases a school's funding on the poverty of the surrounding community. But what happens when a neighborhood undergoes gentrification, right?
Right.
The area gets wealthier, but the actual learners attending that school are commuting in from poorer townships.
Yeah, suddenly the wealth of the neighborhood doesn't match the reality of the student body at all.
Exactly. So does geographically based funding accidentally leave those commuting learners behind? Something for you to think about next time you see a school in a changing neighborhood. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.